Why is this event transdisciplinary, and what does that mean for the attendees?
Well, it's transdisciplinary because the construct that we're dealing with, what we eat, is a really complicated phenomenon. It includes social factors, it includes biology, it includes the environment, it's a public health issue, and then there's also basic science components that people are interested in, what happens in our brain, what happens in our gut, and how they're related. So if we really want to understand why people eat what they do, how we can change what they eat, how we can get them to eat healthier, what the problems are, then we need to understand it from all the different perspectives. And for the audience, it just gives them a rich appreciation of the breadth of the field. I think, as you mentioned, people often work, you know, in sort of isolated disciplines, and having an event like this that spans those disciplines gives us an appreciation for the richness of the problem.
And what were some of the highlights from your field of psychology?
Well, I think one of the interesting things is that sometimes what seems like it might be common sense or be the right thing to do ends up not really being all that beneficial. So Diane Newmark-Stainer, who was our keynote speaker from the University of Minnesota, she's done some great work with following up teens from when they were 12, 13 years old, following them for a decade. And you can look over time at how various factors influence them. And some of the things that she's shown that are actually problematic is if these were teenagers who were on a diet to lose weight when they were younger, as teens, 10 years later, they're more likely to be overweight. They're more likely to engage in disordered eating behaviors. So it actually seems like being on a diet when you're a teenager can have long-term negative outcomes. Similarly, there was some research she presented looking at how parents interact with their teens, and those parents who were telling their overweight teens that they should diet and lose weight, later on, those teens were less likely to have positive outcomes. So those negative comments from the parents at an early age had a lasting impact. So that's, I think, you know, from the psychology perspective, it's that the things that we think are maybe being helpful when we're trying to motivate somebody are not necessarily going to end up being helpful long term.
Right. And one of the highlights was the model from the fake food buffet. What is the advantage of using those model foods in eating studies?
Well, I think there's just a practical benefit, which is that if you're doing an eating study and you have to prepare fresh food for each participant, it's expensive, there's a lot of food wastage and so on, and you might not be able to get standardized portions across all participants and so on, but by using the fake foods, it just gives that degree of flexibility. You don't have to waste food, and you can have people handling the food without having to worry about that side of it. So as much as anything, it's a practical benefit.
Right. Now, if you're just tuning into The Daily this morning, we're speaking with Professor Lenny Vartian from the University of New South Wales about some of the highlights of the Eating and Appetite Symposium last Friday. Now, Lenny, Professor Diane Newmark-Sizer from the University of Minnesota, she presented data from a longitudinal study in adolescence and dieting. Now, the paper and resulting questions focus on the perennial question, is dieting helpful or harmful? And what did you think of her findings?
Well, I think it's complicated. And there was another presentation at the start of the symposium that focused on using these very low-calorie diets under medical supervision and sort of the benefits of those, whereas the work from Professor Newmark-Stainer showed that long-term, the dieting has negative consequences. And I think the key there is, what do we mean by dieting? So if you happen to be somebody who's overweight or obese and you're undergoing a supervised behavioral change program, medically supervised, you're doing it in the right way, and it's not a long-term process, then that's probably okay. But longer term, if you're doing the kind of fad or crash diets that people typically do when they go on a diet, then that's going to have negative consequences down the stream. So I think it raises the point that it's a complicated question. It depends on whether we're talking about short-term or long-term outcomes, and it depends on what we mean by diet. Are we doing something that's being supervised by a medical practitioner, or are we just doing the latest crazy thing that's popped up on a bookshelf somewhere?
Yeah. Now, Some terms that may be unfamiliar to our listeners include weight mistreatment and positive health talk. What exactly do these mean?
Well, weight mistreatment, there's a lot of terms that are used for that. It could be weight teasing, it could be weight stigma, it could be weight bias. Essentially, what that has to do with is when people treat somebody negatively because of their weight. And we know from all other areas in which we have kind of general social concerns, you know, discriminating against somebody because of their race or religion or sexual orientation or anything else is not good. We can all appreciate that. But it seems like when it comes to weight, people have this idea that if we somehow make people feel bad enough about their bodies, that it will motivate them to change their behavior. And there's lots of data, including data from Professor Newmark Stainer's work, that shows that, in fact, that's not the case. That if you stigmatize somebody because of their weight, if you make them feel bad about their bodies, if you're trying to use that as a tool to motivate them, it will backfire, and they will end up being worse off, not only psychologically, but even in terms of their weight and in terms of their behaviors downstream.